Hello, I'm Emma Desi, and welcome to another episode of Turning Readers into Writers. If you're brand new here, welcome, and here's what you need to know. This is a community that believes you are never too old to write your first novel. No matter what you've been up to until now, if you're ready to write your book, I'm ready to help you reach the end. I focus on helping you find the time and confidence to begin your writing journey, as well as the craft and skills you need to finish the book. Each week I interview debut authors, editors, and industry experts to keep you motivated, inspired, and educated on all things writing, editing, and publishing. If you want to catch up, head on over to emmadesi.com, where you'll find a wealth of information and tools to help you get started. Before we dive in, this week's episode is brought to you by my private Facebook community, also called Turning Readers into Writers. It's a safe space for writers from all over the world and at all stages of their writing career. In the group, you'll not only find community, but guest interviews and daily lives where I give you my thought for the day. You can suggest podcast topics and guests, and you get access to upcoming events and programs. So don't stay a lone wolf. Head to Facebook and search for Turning Readers into Writers, and I'll be there to welcome you in. Okay, let's dive into today's episode. Ruby Peru has been a ghostwriter specialising in memoir for 15 years. She also has a witty novel out called Bits of String Too Small to Save. She has travelled far and wide to research and write memoirs for her clients, including everything from cult escapes to African wildlife research, from epic romance to prison memoirs. She has innumerable interesting and funny stories and insights on the essence of memoir, as well as tips on how to write your own. She describes herself as a sloppy workaholic and independent operator. Ruby drives a beat-up pickup truck and restores old houses. Some opine she's a little bit of a badass. Having studied with Kurt Vonnegut in the 80s and David Foster Wallace in the 90s, she'd love to be a person who surfs, climbs, cruises around looking cool on a motorcycle, and never runs out of adventurous weekends. But she isn't, and she doesn't. She's a writer. Her first novel, Bits of String Too Small to Save, which came out in 2017, is a witty, illustrated fantasy for adults that asks, what's really the difference between animals and people? And aren't magic and technology the same thing? And what's the relationship between seduction and just plain manipulation? And what makes a place a home? Well, let's chat to Ruby and find out the answers to all of these questions, and of course, find out about her own writing. Well, Ruby, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Emma.
Pleasure. I wondered if we could just start off by asking, you know, what brought you to writing? What was it that was the inspiration for you? You know, is it something you've always wanted to do, or did you come to it a little bit later in life?
Well, I've always been a writer ever since I was a kid, and through growing up, it was always a big focus for me. But then I became trained as an actor, and that was something I became very involved in, but didn't really make it as an actor. So it led me back to writing, but with a new perspective, because I use a lot of techniques that actors use in my writing.
Ah, could you give us an example?
Well, yeah, sure. I do ghostwriting. I do memoir ghostwriting. That's the primary type of ghostwriting that I do. And that means that other people have their life stories that they want to tell. Sometimes a very complex, epic story. Sometimes it's a romantic story. Sometimes it's an action story. You know, sometimes it's just like, I want to teach you all about my business techniques, all kinds of different things. But with my acting background, I'm able to really sort of embody their life and experience their emotional experiences personally, so that when it comes out on the page, it feels like it was them. Mm-hmm. What you look for when you're plotting, when you're analyzing a script as an actor, And also when you're plotting a book as a writer, you're looking for moments where the person changes, where they have a moment and it changes their outlook on life permanently, you know, and after that moment, you're different. So as an actor, you go through the script and you get to a certain point and you go, boom, that's a beat change. And that means everything is different now. Now I'm viewing things differently. I'm trying to achieve different goals with the things that I'm saying and doing. And so you have to stop and you have to realize that internally you have changed as a person after this moment. So as a writer, I do the same thing. I try to find those moments of change and emphasize them in the book and show how the person has like become a different person because of an event that happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fascinating because it's really delving into that character development that we might think of in fiction, but applying it equally to nonfiction about someone's life and those key points, as you say, that change their self-belief or the beliefs about the world, and then ultimately change kind of how they progress with their life and the decisions they make about their life going forward.
Because ultimately fiction wouldn't make sense unless it was based on people's actual lives. You know, we're just making up people, but we're putting them through the same things that real people go through. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a good reminder about that when we're developing our fictional characters to remember that they are people.
And they should have the same depth of character that real people have, you know? And one thing that I learned a lot from ghostwriting is everybody is a mass of contradictions. Everybody I have ever interviewed, and I do interviews like 30 to 40 hours of interviews with these people. It's very intense. And what I learned about everybody is that they're very much one way, and yet they are the total opposite also on alternate Tuesdays. You know, everybody is a mass of contradictions. And one of the things that happens a lot when I'm talking to beginning writers is they worry that their character doesn't seem realistic because they have these different conflicting things. And I'm like, no, that makes it more realistic. You have to understand people. The more conflict in their soul, the more conflict in their behavior, the better. It just has to make sense to them. You know, they have to have both of those sides of them because that's how people are.
Yeah, I love it. You've mentioned that it's memoir ghostwriting that you do. What was the particular draw to memoir ghostwriting as opposed to fictional ghostwriting, for example?
Ghostwriting is a weird thing because you're writing for somebody else and you're not getting credit for it. At this point in my career, I get credit for stuff. But for 15 years, I wrote books for people without getting any credit. And I'm happy to do it when I'm writing somebody's memoir because it's their story. It's their life story. I'm just the technician who's helping them get it on paper. And I don't mind not getting credit for it because I just feel like I'm helping them tell something that already belongs to them. But when it's fiction, I would have to make it up. I would have to, like, it would all be me. It's me, my story, my writing, everything is me. Why would I not get credit for that? That would not seem fair to me. Whereas memoir ghostwriting seems fair, a fair exchange. You know, if they pay me, I help them put their story on paper.
Oh, I see. And so I'm wondering what, you know, apart from the fact that you are writing about somebody else's life, are there any kind of key differences or key difference of approach when you're writing somebody else's memoir as opposed to your own either fiction or if you're writing memoir as well for yourself?
Yes, I'll tell you this. When I write memoir for other people, I do this intense interview process. I organize all the information. I write a synopsis that is like a very detailed outline of the characters, their external conflicts, their internal conflicts, their relationships with each other. I plan it all out. And then I write it and sort of paint by numbers at that point because everything's planned out. Mm-hmm. And that way the client knows exactly what they're getting, right? When I write for myself, I don't do that. No way. Way too much work. Takes all the fun out of it. And I also find, I've also taught classes recently in memoir writing, and what I started doing is really encouraging my clients to write short stories instead of trying to write long books. It's not that it's easier. Mm-hmm. It's just that it helps you get to the meat of what you're trying to say when it's a short story, because what will happen is you'll be like, oh, I want to tell a story about the time I went to the beach or whatever. And so you're writing about, okay, this happened. And then I'm going, okay, so, but where's the main conflict of the story? What is the main thing where this character wants something that's difficult to get, or the character's up against some kind of difficult challenge? And then they realize there are actually several challenges in this story. And they realize they actually have four stories. You could write four stories about that trip to the beach, because each one focuses on a different conflict, whether it's internal or external. So when you break it down into short stories, you get more bang for your buck story-wise. Mm. And also each story is more focused and more interesting because it's less scattered.
Mm-hmm. So do you write short stories yourself?
Yes. So I'm writing my own memoir now, and it's in short story format. I'm a huge fan of David Sedaris, who's written numerous hilarious memoir books that are all short story based. And that, I think, is also the funniest way to write. And I want it to be funny. So it's about growing up on a horse ranch and going to everything that happened before that and everything that happened after that and various things. And it was sort of an interesting transitional phase of my life. So I'm writing, and because it's memories, you know, they kind of come in chunks. So it works better to me to write it as short stories.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting then. So you're not writing your own memoir in the same way that you do other people. So you're not planning it out in the same way, but as one continuous story, it sounds like, but breaking it down into those key moments that helped you transition from one phase to the next, or one thought change to the next.
Yeah. Like it's, you know, when you're writing a coming of age story, something about when you were a child, then it's always a story about change, because that's, children are constantly going through change. That's what makes them adults. So looking back on that period of my life, I'm able to realize how much that changed me in a very short time. And then I'm able to pick out the specific memories that were key to those changes, not just changing me, but changing my relationships with people, making me understand things about my parents and other people, and sort of having revelations and going, oh, so that's the way things really are, you know? And each of those moments of change is interesting enough to have a short story around it, you know, rather than trying to put it into one big book. I don't really think that I have a big book in me as far as my life. You have to be like 80 years old to be able to look back and see, you know, what was the grand theme of my life? Like, but I can, and I think anybody of any age can look back and go, you know, this specific memory sticks with me for a reason. What is that reason? Stop and think about it. What is that reason? Why do you remember that weird little thing that seems like nothing? Seems like just like, oh, this day that I was having breakfast with my dad or whatever. And like, why do you remember that? Think about it. Because whatever the reason is, it's because something changed in you. You mm-hmm. realized something, and it made you look at the world differently forever. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes a short story.
Yeah. Well, I've never thought about short stories in that way. I confess I'm one of those people who really struggles with short stories. I find them harder to write than 80,000 words for whatever reason, but making them concise, making them impactful, making them in the small container, I find it really, really challenging.
It is hard because it's forcing you to be better. It forces you not to ramble on. It forces you to get to the point. It forces you to realize, what is this about? You know?
Yeah. So I need to work on that. And I did have a question that was going to come out of that, and it's completely gone out of my head. Maybe if it's important, it will come back to me. Now, you mentioned, and I mentioned it in the introduction to the episode, that you have worked under or studied under two very well-known, well-respected writers, Kurt Vonnegut and David Foster Wallace. So that must have been amazing experiences. And I wondered if there were any particular takeaways that you had from your time studying with them and that you still use to this day, and that you might be willing to share with our listeners.
I'll go backwards. Dave Wallace, I studied with in graduate school, and he was such a stickler for grammar. I mean, it was like he would just absolutely come to class infuriated if people said, this is one of his things, you've got another thing coming. The expression is, you've got another think coming, apparently, according to Dave. And he would get so angry if you would somebody use that expression in a book, you've got another thing coming. And he was like, no, the expression is, you've got another think coming. And I related to that because I care about these things as well, like grammar, punctuating things right, getting you know, you understanding what words mean so that you can be concise and using them properly, you know. So he gave me permission to be as uptight as I want to be, you know, because he was very uptight about things like that.
You worked well together then. That was a good thing.
Yeah. And Kurt Vonnegut gave a lot of lectures when I was at Carnegie Mellon, and he would sort of give these grand sweeping lessons on plotting, you know. It was like really the opposite of Dave in a way. He was always comparing everything to Hamlet, because this was his big thing that he was always coming back to. If you take a fairy tale, you know, a Cinderella or something happens and it's bad. Oh, she has to work as a scullery maid. Then something happens and it's good. Oh, she gets an invitation to the ball, and then she loses her slipper and it's bad. And he would like make this graph, and he would graph it on the graph. Up is good, down is bad. Up is good, down is bad. He would make it like on an XY axis, graphing the story. So you can see in a typical story, like a fairy tale, good things happen and bad things happen, and they are followed one by after the other. But in a story like Hamlet is kind of like, well, I wonder if my uncle actually killed my father. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it true? Is it a lie? I don't know. So it's not good or bad, sort of in between. And then like, well, I don't know, maybe I should take this action. But then again, I don't know. Is the ghost real? Is the ghost not real? I don't know. So Hamlet's line is kind of like a straight line across the middle, where you never really know if anything's good or bad. And he says, that's a good story.
Okay.
You never quite know where you're at.
So quite different to what we sort of get taught by most people, in most classes, that normally we're looking to stretch up to the highest of the highs, the lowest of the lows, really emphasizing the conflict going on in the story. But he was kind of suggesting, actually, the more ambiguous it is, almost the better.
Yeah, sort of like, I think what he was stressing was that the conflict is internal. There's so much internal conflict in Hamlet that it's impossible for Hamlet to really know if he's in a situation that's good or bad. So I think what he was emphasizing was to keep the internal conflict really high, mm-hmm. you know, so that the reader never feels safe. They never feel like, oh, I know that good things are happening or bad things are happening. As soon as you think it's good, it's actually bad. As soon as you think it's bad, no, it's actually good.
Well, so two great kind of takeaways then from your times with both of those people, that necessity to be precise with your grammar and your punctuation and the word choices that you're using, and then mm-hmm. to really delve down into that conflict of your character. And the more conflicted they are, the more interesting and unsafe, I like that word, unsafe, that your reader feels. It keeps them going. Now, so talking of plot and character and grammar, you published your first novel in 2017 called Bits of String Too Small to Save. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about it.
Well, okay, so this book started because at one point in my life I taught Montessori school to little kids, and I used to tell them a story every day. That was our initial circle time. I would just extemporaneously just start telling them a story, and they were all participants in the story. And if somebody was wearing like a side ponytail, I'd put the ponytail in the story and whatever was going on, and they loved it. I mean, they would just sit there totally quiet behaving, just waiting to see when they were going to appear in the story. You know, it was really fun. But I left that job And I really missed that creative burst that I got every morning from doing that. It was hard work, and it was fun, and it was a really great workout for my mind. So that's what made me start writing bits of string. And so the rule was, I ended up going to this corporate job that I hated. So I said, all right, I'm going to keep my soul alive by writing a novel. And the rule is, you spend an hour a day and you just have fun. I have to be having fun, not allowed to do anything that's not fun during my writing time. So I started creating these fun characters, crazy dialogue, and just gave them these weird quirks and just had them interact in ways that was like, I didn't care what the plot was going to be. I just wanted to have these interesting characters. And I would take characters from my real life, and I would take, there's one character in there that's a combination between my landlady and my boyfriend at the time. And I was like, they're the same person. That's fun, you know? And so I had a lot of fun with it. And then I created so many weird subplots and scenarios that it was a giant mess. And then I spent many years trying to make sense of all of it and make it into something that made sense. But I wanted it. It started out with this kind of very sing-song, almost like a children's book sound to it. Cause it's just come from working for the children, but then it sort of morphed into something that wasn't a children's book. And so then I kind of didn't know what it was. I was just having fun. And that's sort of the problem with marketing it. Nobody knows quite what it is. But they call it upper YA, new adult or upper young adult. And I wanted it to look like a classic, classic children's storybook, like Alice in Wonderland or 1001 Arabian Nights, where they have these illustrations. It's not a comic book. It just has an illustration at the beginning of each section. So there's four beautiful pen and ink illustrations inside, in addition to the one on the cover. Mm-hmm. So it's meant to look kind of classic in that way.
It certainly does. I'm going to put a link to it so that people can go and look. It's absolutely beautiful. It's beautiful. I'm just really interested in the origin of the book. I think you've given us all there a good reminder that writing is supposed to be fun. I think when we're newbies, particularly, we're so intent on getting this finished product. We're so intent on finding an agent. We're so intent on getting this this piece of work out into the world that we forget that this is something we enjoy, and it's supposed to be fun, and it's supposed to be our downtime often, because it's something we do in and around our paid work. You know, it's supposed to be that rejuvenation that we're looking for, that creative stimulus. And so I love the fact that your book has come out of Montessori, essentially, and been influenced by that, and that although, as you kind of said, at the end of putting all those images and stories and characters together, it was a big old mess. You had fun doing it, and it was joyful, and it brought you a lot of happiness. Yeah. And I think this is something we often forget about. And so I love the fact that you've reminded us that that's important. But you've also sort of highlighted something else. I think a lot of new writers mentally struggle with the idea that this first draft, this first coming together of characters and story ideas, is a big mess. It is a jumble. That even if you're a big plotter, you've got to start with this jumble of ideas and jumble of characters before you put them into some kind of order. It's certainly something that students have said to me before, that it bogs them down, it worries them, and possibly unnecessarily, that it does feel like this big old mess. I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit. You know, is it just through rereading and rereading the work, through revising the work continuously, that those sort of tangles, strings kind of begin to unravel, and the storyline and the character development eventually rises to the top?
It's different for every writer. So there's no set answer I can give you. And also, it's weird because when I wrote that book, I knew nothing about marketing. And now I do publishing and marketing for people on books. And I, in a way, I wish I was still that person who knew nothing about marketing, because that book was a pure expression of creativity with absolutely no compromises being made for the sake of attracting any particular reader. People say, who was your audience? I say, my audience is myself. I wrote it for me. I wanted to have fun. I did have fun. I hope other people have fun when they read it, you know? But then when you're looking at it from a marketing perspective, and a lot of writers have looked into the sale, the potential sale of their book way before they've actually written the book. And that, I'm not going to say it's a mistake. I'm going to say it does inhibit your creativity, but it could be helpful for you for sales. So who am I to say that you shouldn't do that? You know, because obviously you want to sell. It sort of depends on whether you have a purist mindset where you just want to be a person who has a pure creative expression, or if you want to gear towards sales. And there's a lot of research you can do that to give you an idea of exactly what people are looking for and to write towards a market, mm-hmm. you know. But if you're, to answer your question, if you're working from a place of pure creativity and you're just putting all these ideas on the page, it helps to be familiar with all the different formats that are out there. Because if I had known, like, part of the reason my book doesn't qualify as a children's book is because it has way too many subplots. You know, it's also 100,000 words. So that's another reason. It has way too many subplots, and children aren't expected to be able to follow that many subplots. They do all tie together, but you have to remember some things as you go through, because it sort of alternates the different characters until the characters start to coalesce in the story and come together. And if I had known that there are formats out there, you can write a series of novellas, you can write animated stories that you post online on certain sites. You can write, so many different formats exist nowadays other than the classic novel. And the shorter formats tend to sell better, especially if you have a series. If you think of it as, okay, I'm writing all these crazy different threads, right? But if, instead of thinking I'm gonna, don't do what I did, which is you take all these threads and it's like at the end of this 100,000 word book, all the subplots are gonna coalesce and it's gonna be one big dramatic ending. That's great, but it's hard to sell a book that long. So if when you're writing, you think of it, you think of it in terms of creating endings within the story, creating an ending, wrapping it all up into an ending way before you get to the point where it's a huge book. You know, say you're at 30,000 words, create an ending, wrap it up a little, write another 30,000, create another ending, wrap it up. That will enable you to break it into pieces and market it as a series, you know?
Right.
If you let all the threads drag out and drag out and never coalesce, you're going to end up with a very long book, which is not intrinsically bad. That's what I ended up with, and I love it. But you'll get more readers if you write a series of short books.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to be the big way at the moment. People are loving series, especially fairly rapidly released series. It's enjoyable. Now, the one thing you haven't done, though, is tell us what the story's about. I'd love to hear maybe one or two of these subplots.
Okay, so I started out with this theme almost like Alice in Wonderland, but in a kind of post-apocalyptic, not apocalypse, it's kind of like a futuristic world where Elizabeth Ann's this 10-year-old character, and she's in this world where it's a police state, it's futuristic, there's a lot of control. Her grandma's this wild and crazy hot rod driving lady. She's the character that has a combination between my landlady and my boyfriend. And they have this dog. I don't know why I included that. I just wanted to, because I was just thinking, what would the kids like? Oh, a dog, you know. And they go through a hole, kind of like Alice in Wonderland going through the rabbit hole, right? So they go through this portal into another world. And in this world, the scenario is grandma has been to this other world before. It's called Bumble Green. And grandma has been there before. And this was not a pandemic story. I finished it in 2017, but It's a pandemic story because there was a blight on the land and it killed people and animals and everything. And they were trying to figure out what was causing it. And grandma was brought there because she was a scientist to help them figure it out. And she figured it out, but nobody believed her. And everybody thought a different thing caused it. And so she trained Elizabeth Ann her whole young 10 years old life to come to Bumble Green and somehow save this world. And so Elizabeth Ann had no idea she was being trained for this. So she gets there and she's on her own and she has to solve some very big problems, finding people that have been in hiding because they know the true secret of the land and how to solve the problem and how to save everybody. And she has to go around finding clues, meeting all these people, trying to figure out who will be her ally, who's against her. And there's this, one of the diseases is that animals turn into people. And that's also a theme. That's one of the silly bits that's in there, but it's also very deep because animals are so serene. They don't ever worry about things, you know? And I just envy them so much. That's why we have pets. They're just so great. They're so much better than us. They just hang out and have fun every moment. Never think about the future or the past, you know? Yeah. And then when these animals become people in the story, they're tortured by all these neuroses that humans have. And it's so horrible. And they're like, oh God, when will I turn back into an animal? You know, so, and yet there's also one animal, and I won't tell you who chooses to become a person for the sake of true love.
Oh, and, a little bit of romance never goes amiss. Yeah. Love it. Now, you have mentioned that you wanted to have this beautiful look to the book, reminiscent of Alice in Wonderland and 1001 Arabian Nights. And so you found an illustrator and beautiful, they're gorgeous, the illustrations. A couple of questions around that would be, how did you find your illustrator? And then what was it like working together? Was it did you give them a brief and they went away, worked, came back? Did you work together? How did that relationship evolve?
Okay, so it was interesting. I found this guy on Etsy. I was looking for somebody to do pen and ink and I didn't know where to go, but I found myself on Etsy and I found him there. His name's Philip Harris. He's brilliant. He's British. And now he's with an agency. I asked him if he wanted to do these illustrations. And I said, yeah, but what I did not realize was he's dyslexic. I was hoping that he would read the chapter and then be like, here's what I'm inspired to draw. But he said, like, we had this like weird conversation at first where he was like, I'm not going to read the whole chapter. And I was like, why not? Why are you making such a big deal of it? And so finally he was like, well, I guess I could have somebody read it to me. And I realized, oh my God, this poor guy, you know, that's why he's such a brilliant illustrator, because he's just very focused on that side of things. So he got somebody to read it to him, and then we discussed it, and then I had to come up with, there's a Elizabeth Ann is a 10-year-old girl, and then there's another girl who's a queen who's 13, and they are very different. And so he wasn't getting it right in the illustration, so I just went online and I created a Pinterest page of pictures of little girls who are the right age, you know, and have the right kind of look about them for each girl, so that he could sort of amalgamate these different images and go, oh, okay, I get the idea. And then also costumes, like the queen wears this very elaborate costume. So I described it, but I also tried to take take images from things that I found online and put them into a Pinterest page for him, so he could see all of my ideas and then just put them together in his own way.
What a great idea, because clearly he's much more a visual person than kind of a words person. And so having those visuals there to inspire him or take ideas from, I imagine that worked really, really well. What a great idea.
But one thing that I did in the book, I have a fan club for people who love the book. And if you read the book and then you decide to join the fan club, you get a free little PDF that I created, two of them actually, that show you the process of creating these illustrations. The first illustration Philip did for me, and then how I asked him to change it, and then he changed it. I mean, even the bad ones are great, you know, they're amazing. And so you can watch the changes in the character through the sequence of illustrations that he did. And there's another one. The other PDF is about creating the cover, which has many of the characters on it. And so we went from his initial idea to like tweaking every little character on the cover, and so that you can see all the phases that it went through before it became the ultimate thing. It's really cool.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, I'll put a link to the fan page if people are interested as well, so they can check it out. Yeah, cool. Now, I want to just slightly change tack and move on to the other thing that you do. And you've mentioned it briefly at the beginning, but I know you help writers kind of with their own writing through editing. And then also you mentioned that you help them to publish their books. So can you tell us a little bit more about the services that you offer for writers and how in the ways in which you're able to help them?
Yeah, I have a small imprint called Pangloss Press. And that has a website that you can see for some of the books that I've published. But not all the books are on the website, because I also help people who don't want to be necessarily published through my thing. And so, essentially when you're doing indie publishing, you need to sell, but you can't just stick it up on Amazon and expect people to buy it, right? That you have to go through a launch process where, you do a big push to promote the book at a discounted price, get it out to a lot of readers who will then hopefully recommend it to their friends. And then you do, over time, you do more promotional things where what people typically do is you raise it back up to a normal price, and then you'll have a phase where it's like, for 1 week, it's only 99 cents. And then you do a special promotion. And there are lots of different promotions out there that appeal to lots of different email lists that exist for people who have expressed interest in eBooks of different types, you know? Mm-hmm. So I've created this giant database of promotions so that whatever type of book you have, I can find the promotions that will seek out the lists of people that are interested in that particular thing.
Okay. Excellent. Do you help people in all different genres?
Yes, all different genres. Yeah. Nonfiction is much easier to sell than fiction, because if you need a book about such and such, you already know. Mm-hmm. You know, you just go and you look at all the books about panda bears or whatever it is you want to buy, and you go, oh, this is a good one, and you buy it. You know, fiction is something where you have to like really pique somebody's imagination, and you have to appeal to them emotionally and get them to be like, oh, I really want to know about that. Or, you know, it's not a real thing. It's a fictional story. But, and of course there are people who are just absolutely love romance or who absolutely love science fiction. And that's one way of appealing to people when you're in a genre like that. But if you have a book that's not really in a particular genre, it's just a really interesting book, those are harder to sell. But because I'm a glutton for punishment, those are the kinds of books I love to sell, because I like to help writers like me find readers, you know. Mm-hmm. It's really great. And when you succeed, it's amazing.
But you also do editing as well?
Yes. Well, I mean, I ghostwrite, I edit, I do all that stuff. And typically when you have a book that's seeking publication, I'll look at it and usually it's like, okay, we need to do some editorial stuff. If it's all ready to go, maybe all you need is a proofread. And that's, you know, very simple. Just make sure all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted. Or you might, you know, as a person with as much experience in writing as I have, I often will give somebody a developmental edit where it's like, okay, let's try to work on this plot a little bit and make it a little bit more suspenseful, or make it a little bit more, take out some of the slow parts and tighten it up a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. So I help people with that to get the manuscript ready for then the publication phase, mm-hmm. which, you know, the next phase.
Yeah. I'm just out of curiosity, so from your experience, how long do people need to, how far in advance should people be thinking about if they want to hire an editor? Because it's not one of those things you can say, okay, I've finished my draft, I'll send it to an editor tomorrow. Roughly kind of how long do you need to, people need to plan for that? Is it 3 months, 4 months? Not just for your own services, but your own experiences of hiring editors as well.
No, it's not 3 or 4 months. It shouldn't take that long. Well, I did have somebody hire me recently, like 3 or 4 months in advance, because I was busy. But there are a lot of editors out there. So the time situation is just depends on how busy any given editor is. You know, I mean, it's just different for different people. You may find somebody who's having a lull in their business and they can start right away. The main thing is to look at work that they've done, you know, and say, okay, would I like my book to turn out like this? Do I like the way that you want to know what, not a lot of people don't know what type of editorial help they need. Mm. And let me just give you a really quick rundown. Proofreading is just like grammar and punctuation. A proofreader will not fix your plot if it's slow or drags or whatever. That's just grammar and punctuation. You have a copy editor, which is sort of the next step up, who will look at your sentence craft, look at your paragraphs and go, yeah, I think I could rewrite this paragraph, make it a little bit tighter. So they'll rewrite things for you. And then you have a developmental edit, which is where somebody who knows how to write books and plot books and create stories will look at your whole story, read the whole thing, and give you advice in terms of like, okay, look, this chapter, you don't even need it. Cut it out. Or like the ending should be at the beginning. The beginning should be at the end. Or this character is flat. They should either cut them out or give them a little bit more depth. And here's the way to do it. The thing about working with a really good editor, especially in terms of developmental, is that then they can not only pinpoint your problem, they can tell you how to solve it. So it's much better than working with a writing group of other amateurs. Oh, sure, they'll pinpoint your problems, but they don't know how to solve any of them. So when you're working with an editor, it's just a lot quicker process. They'll pinpoint your problem and they'll teach you how to solve it. Mm-hmm. And you can get as much help from them as you want or can afford, or you can have them just give you advice and then you do it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I had my first book edited, that was the biggest surprise to me. I knew that they'd be highlighting what was wrong with it, but it was also an amazing lesson in craft and structure and all of those things because of the advice and the suggestions that were given by that editor as well. I think I learned more in that one report than I did in, you know, 3 years of evening classes. It was amazing. Exactly. Amazing. So people can find more about that editing service and publishing service on your website, is that right?
Yeah, rubyperu.com.
Cool, we'll link to that too. So you mentioned it a little bit earlier on that you're working on your own memoir. How's that coming along? Can we expect that anytime soon?
I don't know about anytime soon. I have to do it in my spare time. But I've got two of the stories written and it's, you know, it's probably going to have 20 stories in it or something. So it's called Sleazy Peach and it's not out yet. So don't go looking for it. But if you're interested in finding out, just join my fan club and then I'll update you on all the next upcoming stuff.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So tell us where's the best place for listeners to either find out more about the work that you do or connect with you online?
rubyperu.com, rubyperu.com. And then that's where you can join my fan club if you like Bits of String Too Small to Save, or you can get on my newsletter, which just gives you updates on whatever blogs I put out. You can read about my work as a ghostwriter. You can, you know, read all about whatever I'm up to. And then if you get on either of those lists, I'll update you on everything I'm doing.
Fantastic. That's lovely. Well, Ruby Peru, thank you so much for your time today. I really loved chatting to you.
Thank you, Emma. I really enjoyed this as well. I really appreciate you giving me a chance to talk to people.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Now, if you'd like to find some more ways to write, you can download my free cheat sheet, 30 Top Tips to Find Time to Write, by going to emmadesi.com/30toptips. If you'd like to connect with me, you can find me on Facebook at Emma Desi Author. And if you're enjoying the podcast so far, please don't forget to leave a review wherever you download your podcasts. It really does help new listeners find the show. And of course, I appreciate your support. Until next time, keep writing.